Yeah, you Mountain Ute, we'd have to go on trucks because there, in order to get to their Sundance, the only vehicles that could get up there were trucks, four-wheel drives, or you had to go by wagons, horse wagons up there. So they're more isolated. Their Sundance area is more isolated, but it was very nice up on a hill.
What ages were you when you were doing this?
I think I was probably, you know, really young, probably about 8 to 10. You know.
Great time.
And then we'd go to Utah, and that's where I remember the little kids, all the little kids up there spoke nothing but Ute.
Oh.
And so I'd have to talk Ute with them, so that's where I practiced my Ute. Not with my family, but with those little kids, because they didn't talk anything but you. And so, but it was nice, you know, knowing all, going up there and visiting with relatives and meeting with them and going to the dances up there.
Do you remember any of the relatives from these dances? Names and people like that?
Well, the people that we would go and visit were the Washes, like Lula Wash.
Oh.
And
who is she?
She was a relative of my stepmother and my father, and so we'd go and visit them and her children, and, but I don't even know them today. I wouldn't go know them today. I've met some of them, you know, when I travel to conferences. I'll meet a lady and then I'll say, well, are you Lula's daughter? And she'll say, yeah.
Oh.
Or somebody will come and ask me, and that's how we meet each other.
Boy, it must have took a long time to get to these places.
But on my grandmother's side, her father was an ex-slave.
Really?
He was an ex-slave.
What was his name?
John Taylor.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, John Taylor, and then he became a scout for the Calvary.
Which Calvary? Do you know?
I don't even know what Calvary it was.
In what years?
I don't even know the years either. These are just the stories that my grandmother told me, and she said that he had about 10 wives. You know, as he traveled, he must have married different people. So he knew, he was fluent in about 8 languages, Indian languages and stuff, because he had to learn them because of the wives that he married. So,
must have been quite a fella.
Yeah, and then he was about 60-some years old when he came here and married my great-grandmother. And she was only like 14. And I think he was in his late 50s or 60.
That's Euterpe.
That was Euterpe's mother.
Euterpe's mother. And what was her name?
Kitty.
Kitty.
Kitty Cloud Taylor.
Kitty Cloud Taylor. Wow.
Yeah. And so they have a, there's a picture of them, and, you know, he married her in the Catholic Church.
Huh.
And so the property down here where the Catholic Church is on here, the St. Ignatius Church. He donated that church, that land to the church, to the Catholic Church, for them to build a church on there. And he said they could use that land. He would give it to the church as long as they had a Catholic church on there.
Mm. So, do you know where he was a slave when he was younger?
I think he came from Kentucky.
Kentucky.
That's what my grandmother said, that his family came from Kentucky.
Hmm. Oh, that's an interesting story.
Yeah. And they had, my great-grandmother and him, I think they had 12 or 13 kids.
No kidding.
And out of those, only 3 survived. Let's see, Euterpe Taylor and Edwin Cloud Taylor, Henry Taylor, and Frank Taylor.
Frank Taylor.
Yeah, there were four.
Four.
Four of them. And out of those, only two are left, Euterpe and Henry.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then on my grandmother's side, too, she said she had about 12 or 13 kids, but only three survived. And that was my mother, Ruby, my uncle Sylvian, who was the youngest, and then Francis. But Francis is deceased now.
Uh-huh. Wow.
We have a large family, you know, on the Taylor side.
Uh-huh.
And then we also have a large family on the Weaver side also.
Mm-hmm. Super great. Okay.
Well, my experiences in the tribal council,
yes. You know,
some of those experiences have been...
Yes.
In the beginning, it was very hard and very frustrating, because when you enter into a group that has been so male dominated, they tend to overlook you or feel that what you have to say is unimportant, until you have to become assertive and say, uh-huh. Hey, look,
uh-huh.
I have just as much right as you men do, uh-huh. and I want you to listen to what I have to say.
Uh-huh.
So it was difficult in the beginning.
Were any of those men helpful in any way?
Yeah. There was one of the council members, John Baker Sr.
Mm-hmm.
He was very, very helpful. He was very articulate, you know, very. Uh-huh. He had been in tribal council for many, many years, and he was real helpful. Anything that I needed to know, he would. I could go and ask him, and I think Chairman Birch, to an extent, also was helpful.
Okay, all right.
Let's see who else was on there. But well, Chairman Birch, he was helpful in that he had to give me all the, you know, all the paperwork that they had been involved in, and then the tribal attorneys, well, he would refer me to them to give me the updates on maybe some of the things in the past and some of the decisions that were made in the past.
Well, he helped bring you up to speed and all
right.
that. Good.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
But, I don't know, sometimes you feel like you're just spinning your wheels also, and
well,
there were times when I felt like I felt during these 11 years, I would think, you know, what am I doing here? Why am I here? It doesn't seem like things are happening. Are there still the same problems out there? You still have the problems with unemployment. You still have the problems with mm-hmm. alcoholism. You still have the problems with the social kinds of problems.
Uh-huh.
The only place where I think we're making a lot of headway is with our young people.
Good.
With the educational part of it. At, you know, one time we only had, like, well, we have 19 students who have graduated from Fort Lewis, but I think they said as of today we have 42 students who are attending colleges and universities.
Mm-hmm.
Which says something good for the tribe. And
yes,
then we set up this $2 million foundation scholarship fund with Fort Lewis College.
Uh-huh.
So our students are able to attend Fort Lewis College if they want, or they can get a scholarship to go somewhere else.
There you go. That's great. Well, you know, considering the tribal council situation, and one looks back in history, and let's say, like, at the Wheeler-Howard Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, And that gave the tribes limited authority, and part of that was the tribal council. Do you see the authority of the tribal council as being enough? And also, in as a second part of that question, do you look on the tribal council as better than the old traditional councils before?
I think that the Wheeler-Hauer Act, you know, in 1935, when we adopted our constitution bylaws, I think at that time the tribes didn't know what they were getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they thought that they were going to have the full authority to do the things that they wanted to do pertaining to their tribe. But every time you take action,
mm-hmm.
it seems like it has to be approved by the BIA anyway.
Uh-huh.
You know, the BIA still has their hands in there. And I think that the old governments were probably the better kind of governments. So it's like we more or less adopted the way the federal government does business.
Well, which...
Yeah. Which a lot of times isn't very good.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not... It's the way I see, like, after being in there for 11 years, the government is supposed to be a government elected by the people and for the people.
Uh-huh.
And I see, in those 11 years, I see where it's going the other way. It's not really for the people.
It's more or less for the government.
It's for the government, yeah.
Ah. Do you...
For the government and the selected few within that administration.
Right, you know, okay.
Within that organization. And that's not the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be who you are, but you're a stockholder. You have a right...
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and that's the way it should be.
Uh-huh. So you would favor a sort of a going back to the traditional tribal council ways of doing it before...
I don't know. I think that they need more checks and balances. More? I don't think that they have the checks and balances that it needs in order to be an effective government.
In what form would these checks and balances... Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, like right now, we have a government, you know, like we're supposed to have this separation of powers, but you don't really have the separation of powers between your legislative, your executive, and your judicial. You know, you don't. It seems like you do, but you don't.
Uh-huh.
Because like your courts are still under the government.
Uh-huh.
So... You know, the judicial part of it is still under the tribal government. So you don't have that separation.
So you have some political involvement in the judiciary, which
right.
can be trouble.
Right. Uh-huh. So that you have that. And then, let's see, what's that other one? The executive, too, uh-huh. is still underneath. And I don't like that, you know, the way that... As I see the organization, the way it's set up now is that... It's kind of corrupt.
Well, what do you say to people, let's say from the outside looking in, would say, well, fine, have your own government, but we won't give you any more government money from the Bureau of Indian Affairs or the federal government, Treasury. What would you say to those people? Such as the Menominee situation in Wisconsin, where they were cut totally off.
I know, all because they wanted to.
Self-determination.
Self-determination. Wouldn't that be good too?
Think the Southern Utes could survive?
No.
Uh-huh.
No. The reason why I say that is because we haven't really prepared our people to become independent and self-sufficient, because the government is the one that totally controls everything.
Uh-huh.
See, we haven't gone beyond that BIA paternalistic way of doing things. You know, it has to be approved by me before you can do this and before you can do that, instead of saying, you know, do it.
Uh-huh.
Here's this, do it on your own. And we still have that paternalistic attitude towards our own people.
Then you see that as the crux of the problem?
I think so, because you have total control. The government has total control over everything. Their employment, their lands, their waters, their this, their that. They have total control over it.
Mm.
So we have to get beyond that.
Is that the educational aspect?
I think it's going to have to come about with the younger generation. Mm-hmm. Because as long as you have the old guards, you might say, still running the government, they're, I think, in a way that they're afraid of education. Because you see it in your employment. In your employment situation,
uh-huh.
You know, like you're not bringing back your people who are educated, who can help the government. Uh-huh. You know, there's this fear, and that's not just with this tribe. That's with tribes all over. Uh-huh. You know, you hear that when you go to conferences. Well, I'm just as qualified, or I have a degree like this non-Indian, but he gets the job and I don't.
Mm.
And see. I see some of this similar kind of thing happening here too.
Yeah. It's a lot of work yet to do. Yes. Okay. Okay, Lillian. Did you have any relatives involved in historical events such as the Korean War, the World War II, or Vietnam?
Yes. My one of my young brothers, Roland, he went to the Vietnam War, was involved in the Vietnam War. And when he came back, he was a total mess. It was very difficult for him to survive for years. It took he just drowned out his sorrows in alcoholism. Mm. That was the only way to escape the pictures in his mind.
Mm.
And the few times that I think he was in the army. And the few times that I was able to talk with him, the things that came to his mind that really kind of hurt him was when he had to kill young children. Mm-hmm. and women, because the young men, the children were planted with bombs, you know, and you just couldn't trust them, and the women the same way, you know. Mm-hmm. The military would attach those bombs to them and send them in, and so he said, you just really couldn't trust anybody. And that was the thing that really bothered him the most, was having to do those kinds of things. Because he said the Indians were always kind of pushed out there to go first, to go and fight. And then...
during the battles in Vietnam?
During the battles, yeah. They, you know, and so, well, in his,
uh-huh,
in his group.
In his unit.
Yeah, and so... and then the other thing was the smell of death, you know, that you know, you just couldn't get over it. He said it was so strong, the smell of death and blood, and so it took him a long, long time to. His several marriages broke up, you know, because of him and the way he was. You know, his wife just couldn't handle it. And,
what so years was he in Vietnam? Do you know?
I don't really know what years it was.
Or the battles?
No, I don't.
Okay. What's he doing now?
He works with the Bureau of Indian Affairs now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think it's with the Bureau. Yeah, he works with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And he's settled down.
He's getting over
it. I think he's gotten over it now, and so he's putting his life together.
Good. How about World War II?
I don't know if I have any relatives. I'm sure that I do, you know, but because I have a lot of relatives.
Bataan?
Yeah, my mother talks about is that I have my grandmother's nephew. He was in the Bataan Death March.
Uh-huh.
And his name was McKean Taylor. There's a picture of him in the tribal building.
Uh-huh.
I think that's World War II.
Yeah.
Heroes and she said that, you know, when he talked about his experiences, I don't know if he died there or if he came back and he died here,
mm-hmm.
but from what she talks about is that it was really, uh-huh. really bad.
A horrendous period of history.
Mm-hmm.
How about Korean conflict? Nobody that you remember.
I don't know anybody.
Wow. That's really interesting. Gee. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what else we got. Lillian, how did the permission for the oral histories on the Southern Ute Reservation come about? Do you recall that in the tribal council meetings?
I don't know the exact date, but I remember that Dr. Ellis and I think it was Mary Jean Mosley, and I don't recollect any. I know there was a group of people that came in. I think the education, Lee Briggs, came to meet with the tribal council to ask permission for Dr. Ellis to come on the reservation, or he said a group of students, you know, in his class would be coming out and interviewing people so they could put this oral history project together.
Uh-huh.
And the tribal council was real receptive to the idea, and they just said, well, give us names of people who will be coming, and that was it. And uh-huh. the council approved it unanimously.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Wow.
Because Tribal Council thought that it would be a plus to have some kind of oral history, you know, put together, because there's not too much written about the Southern Utes. There's not too much history. And so while people are still alive, you know, like some of the elders,
mm-hmm.
that they would like to get some of what their memories are of history in the past and their thoughts on how things are today, and then, you know, put it together.
Yeah, that whole idea of talking leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The white man has used them for many years. Now
sure.
it's the Indian's turn.
Okay. Yeah.
So, well, I think that's the end of this interview, huh?
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Oh.